We'd all like to believe that time heals all wounds, but a new study suggests that the pain of divorce lasts longer than a lot of families bargained on, longer than many experts predicted. And for the children of divorce, there are powerful and wholly unanticipated emotional aftershocks. These are the conclusions of my guest, psychologist Judith Wallerstein. She's just completed what she describes as the longest study tracking divorced families ever conducted. She began the study in 1971 when she interviewed 60 families who were going through divorce. She stayed in touch with the families, interviewing them 1, 5, 10, and 15 years after the divorce. She selected families from a fairly homogeneous population, mostly white, middle class, and suburban. These families were less likely to face poverty or racism, factors Wallerstein thought could obscure her focus on divorce. At the time of the divorce, the children were doing well at school and the parents were not in clinical treatment for psychiatric disorders. Most of the parents were college educated. Wallerstein describes this as divorce under the best circumstances. Wallerstein analyzes the data from the first 10 years of her study in her new book, Second Chances. I wanted to know which findings surprised her the most.
Well, there were a whole lot of surprises in the study from beginning to end, and I think that's one of the advantages and one of the disadvantages of doing the only such study in terms of the length of time of following these youngsters and following them into young adulthood. What surprised me first was the vividness of memory and the greenness of the feelings that was attached to those memories. A youngster who has spent most of her life in a divorced family, the divorce occurred when she was 5, who at 20 says, "I remember my mother's pain. I remember the night my father left, her sitting up all night in the red rocking chair and crying and rocking, and my crying too." There were a whole lot of memories like that. The 22-year-old man who said, "I saw my dad beat up my mom. That's a scar I think of every day." I didn't expect to have so many of these feelings, as feeling almost as if it was yesterday.
So the pain, the anger, the sense of betrayal lasts a lot longer than you expected it would.
Yes, especially since, as I said, for most of these youngsters, the divorce was more than half their life away. And yet these memories are enclosed. I was also surprised to find that a number of them were dreaming of scenes that they had seen when they were 4 years old.
Well, you found that 41% of the children who you first interviewed when they were young children are doing badly as adults. And I wonder if you think that that's because of the fact that their parents were divorced.
I don't think it's the divorce per se, and I think I think we're looking at a continuum, and I think it's important to bear this in mind, that we're looking at a failed marriage followed by the distress of the divorce, followed by a lot of stresses in the post-divorce family. Now, let me say that 45% of the children are doing very well, and for them, there was at least one adult, for most of them, who was very helpful, who was committed to them, either a mother or a father, who really gave priority to the relationship with the child, and the child felt very much protected in that relationship. Some of these youngsters who were doing well also had a grandparent who was very helpful. Others relied on siblings, but there was a sense that they weren't out there by themselves and alone. Whereas with the youngsters who were doing poorly, they were more likely to feel that they were taking on responsibility for their parents, or that they were taking on responsibilities that were beyond them. As one girl said, "I paid for my parents' divorce, and I gave up my childhood for my parents' divorce." In the families where there were where the children were doing poorly, there were more than one divorce. One half of the youngsters experienced a second divorce during that 10-year period. Mm. So you get a sense of the unreliability of relationships. As one boy said, "I don't know what's the matter with my dad. He keeps marrying and divorcing and marrying and divorcing. And he just doesn't seem to be able to keep any kind of relationship." Well, this is very distressing. One quarter of the children experienced a severe drop economically, and in their home with the mother, whereas the father's home was maintained pretty much at the level that it had been, and they were very much aware of the kind of life that would have been theirs except for the divorce of their parents. And then there was the very serious issue of many of the youngsters not being able to go on to college with any kind of real help or support because child support ends at age 18. Mm-hmm. And very few, this is, I mean, talk about surprises, very few fathers in this group, and these fathers were not poor people. They were professionals. They were physicians. They were attorneys. They were business executives. Very few of the fathers who could afford it, only one third of those who could afford it, to use the exact statistic, sent their children with support through college.
Was that because they were no longer close to their children? Did they have children from a second marriage that they felt closer to?
Some of them had children from a second marriage. Some of them didn't feel as close, but all of them were visiting their children. So we're dealing with a subjective feeling, with what I've called a blunting in the relationship between the father and the children, so that the child no longer symbolizes the sense of continuity of, you know, you're going to go to the college that I went to. You're going to go and tell me whether the basketball is just where it was, and so on. The whole sense of the son and the daughter as representing the father in some way was blunted by the divorce, and the children suffered as a result of this.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned one of the children who you've interviewed over the years saying that they feel that they have paid all their lives the price of their parents' divorce. And you've described something as the overburdened child syndrome, where a child basically has to take care of the suffering parent after a divorce.
Yes, we're seeing that. We're seeing parents who really don't recover from the stress of the divorce experience. And where the child takes on the role of holding that parent together psychologically, it's sort of a role reversal, but it's more than a role reversal because the child's presence is also to ward off the parent's loneliness, the parent's depression, the parent's very serious worries, and so on. So we have very young children taking on responsibility for maintaining the parent as a functioning person, which might well have been the role of the other adult within the marriage.
Something else that I think surprised you, which you've called the sleeper effect, that some of the children who seemed to be doing pretty good at the time of the divorce had the after effects really hit them years later.
This was true especially among the girls. Girls generally do very well in most divorced families. This has been true in my own work. This has been true in work done by other researchers throughout the country. And I was very surprised to find that girls who had been doing very well all through high school, had very close relationship with their mothers, and had been doing well in school, on the playground, in their family relationships, that when they came to confronting in a serious way issues of commitment, issues of an enduring relationship, issues of marriage, a real man-to-woman relationship for real at 19, 20, and 21, and so on, that they developed acute anxiety and fear of being betrayed. As one young woman said, if my boyfriend is 30 minutes late, I wonder whom he's with. Another said, I'm afraid to use the word love. Mm-hmm. You can hope for love, but you can't be sure to find it. And you have a real drop in adjustment at that point and a rise in anxiety as these young women suddenly confront for the first time in a very serious way. Obviously, they've had boyfriends during their adolescence, but in a serious way are moving into what eventually becomes the formation of the new family. And obviously, at this point, all their anxieties about the mother-father relationship in their own family takes center stage.
My guest is Dr. Judith Wallerstein, and we're discussing her long-term study of families in which there's been a divorce. And she started the study in 1971 and continues to interview the members of the families, the adults and the children. Her findings are published in the new book, Second Chances. Let's look at your investigation of joint custody, which is really a pretty new phenomenon among families where there's been a divorce. So this is information that's just coming in, you know?
Yes.
And 25 of the couples that you've studied had some form of joint custody. One thing you found is that joint custody seems to work the worst when it's court-ruled, when it's not something that the parents decided to do, but when it's something that the court inflicted on the parents.
Well, inflicted is an interesting verb. The court wouldn't like it, but I agree with you. I really see this as two different family forms. I think when the couple voluntarily select joint custody out of their commitment to the child, and that's one family form, and another where the court, as an authority, comes in when the parents are fighting with each other and tells them this is the way it's going to be. It's sort of a King Solomon's kind of decision. And I think that's destructive for the child, and I think the children that we've seen have looked very poorly under that arrangement.
Why is that destructive for the child?
What's created is a no child's land or no man's land where the child feels welcome nowhere, that when the child leaves the mother's house to go to the father's house, the mother resents the child going. And then as the child goes back and forth, there is no greater comfort and no greater cooperation. The conflict continues, and the child really feels in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a voluntary arrangement, the parents develop ways that encourage the child. The mother will call the father. As I describe in the chapter on joint custody in the book, the mother learns to call the father so she can prepare the child. And so she says, oh, your daddy's waiting for you, and he's going to take you to the zoo, or he's going to take you to this, or whatever. And today's the day you go. And these changeovers that are difficult for young children are eased by the sensitivity of parents who are interested and concerned that the child maintain a relationship with both parents, so that the child needs that kind of help, and that help is the opposite of forthcoming when that child when that arrangement is imposed by the court.
In families where there's a voluntary joint custody, where the parents have initiated it, the child still has to go back and forth between two homes. It's two addresses, two phone numbers, sets of clothes in each house. In some instances, probably. Well, no, I guess that wouldn't be true. There'd be separate schools. But there are a lot of differences from one house to another. What seemed to make that situation more easy to handle, and what made it more difficult for a child to handle when they were constantly going back and forth?
Well, there's several issues. What's imperative is that the parents have a commitment to making it work, and that they give priority to that, and given that, they're then willing to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. So each one doesn't try to impose his or her standard of what's right and what's wrong, whether white bread is a terrible thing or whatever. These issues don't founder on the big issues of religion. They founder on the small issues of sleep time and discipline.
Oh, and television.
And television, exactly, and toilet training and so on. So people have to be able to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. They have to be able not to intrude on each other's lives. And that comes out of a real commitment to the child and a recognizing that the child's relationship with both parents should be given priority. And we're seeing more and more of that as the society gets educated. What's also important is the flexibility of the child. And not everybody's flexible. Not everybody can do it. And you can only tell that, really, by watching what happens with the child and how that child is doing. And here again, you need parents who can be sensitive to how the child is adjusting and fine-tune the arrangement in accord with the child's needs.
Now, you found, too, that it seemed to be more difficult for a child when the duration of their stay at each of their parents' houses was shorter. So, in other words, the more transitions you had to make, the more difficult it was going to be.
Well, there's a certain staccato rhythm that became impossible. We found that children really needed a time to settle into the new home and time to kind of get into with routines and so on, and then a time to prepare to leave. And if it's all going back and forth like under strobe lights, it's too much.
I think you found, too, that the joint custody arrangements seemed to become more difficult when the child became a teenager, at the point when the parents became less central to the teenager's lives.
Exactly. At the point that you need one telephone and one set of peers, and at the point that you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, you sure should not be encouraged to give that up to go stay with your dad or your mom.
Now, what about visitation in those families where there isn't joint custody, but one of the parents has the child living with them and the other parent visits maybe once a week on the weekend or whatever the arrangement is?
Many of our children did very well, and one of the factors that was important in their doing well was whether they were able to maintain a relationship with both parents. And it's hard to maintain a relationship in a visiting relationship, and I think a lot of parents don't realize how difficult it is, but it's not related, and this was a very interesting finding, it's not related to the frequency of the visit or the pattern of the visit or the number of hours in the visit. It really has to do with the capacity of the father and the child to find common interest, for the father to take a real fatherly role, not to play playground director, as some of our parents called their role, and to take that role over the child's developing years, and to stay in touch with the different these different developmental stages. I found, incidentally, and this again was a surprise, is that during adolescence, the boys especially, but the girls too, really experienced a rising need for contact with the father and for a sustained relationship with the father. And the boys wanted a real encouragement from him when they were 16, 17, and 18 in saying, I think you can make it, and as you move away from young adolescence into taking the first steps towards independence and manhood. They wanted encouragement, and they wanted some sense of an independent relationship with the father. And they would frequently seek him out at that point. And many fathers didn't understand this rising need in their sons at that point and weren't as responsive as they might have been had they recognized the importance of this developmentally for the boy. In the girls, we saw it at a somewhat younger age, in early adolescence, when they would reach out to the fathers. And they wanted some acknowledgement from him that they were important, that they were nice, that they were a valued part of his life. And some of the fathers were quite taken aback. One little girl sent her diary to her father 1,000 miles away, and the man was baffled. He didn't realize what a huge compliment had been conveyed.
This is an interesting observation. You think that the children of divorce share a more conservative morality than their parents?
Well, this is my finding, and they don't believe in open marriage. They have very strong feelings about infidelity. Some of them are still angry at their parents for infidelities during their marriage, 10, 15 years ago. I remember this 26-year-old man who said to me, someday I'll say to my dad, are you proud of what you've done with your life? His father was unfaithful throughout the marriage, but this is now 12 years since the divorce, and the boy or the young man is still harboring very angry feelings about this. So you're looking at youngsters who want marriage, who want an enduring relationship, who want commitment, and who want children. And interestingly, who speak about the importance of not divorcing, not only on their own behalf, but on behalf of their unborn children. I thought that was very moving, that they would project it into the future in terms of their unborn children. And as one boy said, I don't want any other child of mine to live through what I lived through.
But we don't really know yet, do we, whether the children of divorce have a higher or lower divorce rate than their parents' generation.
Oh, as a matter of fact, we do.
We do.
The demographics are not what these youngsters want. The mm-hmm. demographics show a higher divorce rate. And in fact, in my own study, of the 8 young women who married early, by early I mean 19, 20, 21, 7 of those divorced already during that 10-year period. So one of the problems that we're looking at is what these young people want is not necessarily what they're doing. I mean, they're very frightened of divorce, but some of them get into relationships in which the divorce becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I guess nobody's really anxious to have a marriage that ends in divorce.
No, but they're anxious not to be abandoned. Mm-hmm. They're anxious not to be hurt. And they get then involved in relationships which, if they feel they'll lose them and they'll be abandoned, aren't going to break their hearts.
Well, this leads to the question, based on your study, do you think that if a couple is having serious problems in their marriage and they have children, do you think that they should stay together for the sake of their children?
Well, about that, I think we have some good information. All of our studies that compare children who are in unhappy and conflict-ridden marriages with children from divorce show that children in divorce look better. And whatever problems we're seeing in divorced families are the ones that I'm trying to address, but I don't think it's good for a child to remain in for the parents to stay married for the child. I think that's an enormous burden for a child to feel. My mother and father remained unhappy because of me.
I guess that gets back to something you were saying before, too, that the negative effects on a child is not just the divorce, but the anger, the sense of betrayal between the two parents. And so if they're feeling this anger toward each other without a divorce, it's not going to make it any better for the child.
Exactly. And I think that's very important. I make that very clear in my book because I don't want to roll things back. I don't want to turn things against divorce. I think we're not doing divorce well. I don't think we're protecting our children economically. I don't think we're protecting them psychologically. And there's a lot of stress in that post-divorce family, which I think we can work on, which I think we can change.
Well, what is doing divorce well?
Doing divorce well is trying to maintain for the child the same economic and psychological protection that that child would have enjoyed in the intact family, to the extent that that's possible. That should be the goal. And that means that people don't have a hunting license to just try to shoot each other down during the years after divorce. It means that if it's important in a good intact marriage to maintain a model of civility and kindness between the parents, and that remains doubly so in a divorced family because the child is already coming out of one marital failure. And you don't want the child to grow up with a vision in his or her head of a man and a woman who can never get along in any way. I don't mean they have to like each other. I don't even care if they forgive each other, but I think they have to deal with each other with a certain civility and kindness. And the other issue that's very important is the child has got to feel that relationships are reliable, that parent-child relationships hold, that a father will maintain his commitment to the child, that the mother will maintain her commitment, and so on. In other words, the child's need for a good family don't modify because that child's in a divorce or in an intact family, and the sense of commitment and responsibility and moral moral behavior on the part of the parents is as important in divorce as it is in marriage.
I'll tell you what surprised me the least in your book, and that is that the person who initiates the divorce usually fares better than the one who didn't want to get divorced. But you did find that 10 years after the divorce, half of the women you studied and two-thirds of the men feel that they don't have a better quality of life than they did before the divorce.
Well, I think that's true. I think we may have been overly optimistic in expecting that people would be able to reconstruct their lives, or they'd be able to find a new mate around the corner and so on. I think also we haven't prepared realistically in terms of women being able to get jobs that take them into a more interesting way of life, that a lot of the women were working at jobs in which they really felt they were in an intellectual dead end, that it was in no way appropriate to their talents. But the issue that of growing disparity within the couple over the 10-year period, so that one person really benefited enormously for the divorce, and the other person was more or less a little bit ahead and being out of a stressful relationship, but not really importantly ahead, I think is a very serious one in terms also of the issues of values. And do you think in terms of value for the whole family? Do you think only in terms of the individual? And how does one make these decisions?
One message that it would be easy to take away from your study is that if you're going to get divorced, chances are you'll be unhappier for a longer period of time, and so will your children, than you expected. Would that be the right message to take away?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think one important message to take away is that the child needs support and help and guidance from a parent, not only at the time of the divorce, but that over the years that follow. And I think we have to change our orientation. I think, for example, it would be very important for a parent to have several discussions with a youngster during their adolescence or as they move into late adolescence and so on, to convey to that youngster openly and explicitly that what happened to me is different from what's going to happen to you, and your experience is separate and different. And I certainly hope that you have a very good relationship with a man or a very good relationship with a woman. I think the issue of children feeling that they're walking inevitably down the same alley that their parents walked can be addressed and should be addressed. I think it would change what parents bring to children, and I think that would clearly affect what happens to them.
Some people look at the number of divorces today and reach the conclusion that the family is falling apart, that the family is in real trouble. Do you reach that conclusion yourself?
I don't think the family's falling apart at all, and certainly all of the children in my study don't believe so. They really want a family, and they want a happy marriage for themselves and the and their children. So there's no evidence that the conclusion that anybody's drawing here is a cynical one or turning one's back on that at all.